And now we're going to hear the soundtrack of a video from last year to a TEDx conference. This is Britta Riley speaking on her idea of window farms. Now, on one level, this is similar to The Incredible Edibles. This is just about increasing food production locally, having a small supply of fresh food. But on another level, again, like Incredible Edible, this is something much more. This is a reconnection with the place that you live in. This is a grassroots demand for reconnection with the soil, something that big agriculture is working hard to suppress, something that a lot of people are working on together, in this case, on a global scale through the internet.
I, like many of you, am one of the 2 billion people on Earth who live in cities. And there are days, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but there are days when I palpably feel how much I rely on other people for pretty much everything in my life. And some days that can even be a little scary. But what I'm here to talk to you about today is how that same interdependence is actually an extremely powerful social infrastructure that we can actually harness to help heal some of our deepest civic issues if we apply open source collaboration. A couple of years ago, I read an article by New York Times writer Michael Pollan, in which he argued that growing even some of our own food is one of the best things that we can do for the environment. Now, at the time that I was reading this, it was the middle of the winter, and I definitely did not have room for a lot of dirt in my New York City apartment. So I was basically just willing to settle for reading the next Wired magazine and finding out how the experts were going to figure out how to solve all these problems for us in the future. But that was actually exactly the point that Michael Pollan was making in this article, was it's precisely when we hand over the responsibility for all of these things to specialists that we cause the kind of messes that we see with the food system. So, I happen to know a little bit from my own work about how NASA has been using hydroponics to explore growing food in space, and that you can actually get optimal nutritional yield by running a kind of high-quality liquid soil over plants' root systems. Now, to a vegetable plant, my apartment has got to be about as foreign as outer space, but I can offer some natural light and year-round climate control. Fast forward 2 years later, we now have window farms, which are vertical hydroponic platforms for food growing indoors. And the way it works is that there's a pump at the bottom which periodically sends some of this liquid nutrient solution up to the top, which then trickles down through plants' root systems that are suspended in clay pellets, so there's no dirt involved. Now, light and temperature vary with each window's microclimate. So a window farm requires a farmer, and she must decide what kind of crops she is going to put in her window farm and whether she's going to feed her food organically. Back at the time, a window farm was no more than a technically complex idea that was going to require a lot of testing. And I really wanted it to be an open project because hydroponics is one of the fastest growing areas of patenting in the United States right now and could possibly become another area like Monsanto, where we have a lot of corporate intellectual property in the way of people's food. So I decided that instead of creating a product, what I was going to do was open this up to a whole bunch of co-developers. The first few systems that we created, they kind of worked. We were actually able to grow about a salad a week in a typical New York City apartment window. And we were able to grow cherry tomatoes and cucumbers, all kinds of stuff. But the first few systems were these leaky, loud power guzzlers that Martha Stewart would definitely never have approved. So to bring on more co-developers, what we did was we created a social media site on which we published the designs, we explained how they worked, and we even went so far as to point out everything that was wrong with these systems. And then we invited people all over the world to build them and experiment with us. So actually now on this website, we have 18,000 people. And we have window farms all over the world. What we're doing is what NASA or a large corporation would call R&D, or research and development. But what we call it is R&DIY, or research and develop it yourself. So for example, Jackson came along and suggested that we use air pumps instead of water pumps. It took building a whole bunch of systems to get it right, but once we did, we were able to cut our carbon footprint nearly in half. Tony in Chicago has been taking on growing experiments, like lots of other window farmers, and he's been able to actually get his strawberries to fruit for 9 months of the year in low-light conditions by simply changing out the organic nutrients. And window farmers in Finland have been customizing their window farms for the dark days of the Finnish winters by outfitting them with LED grow lights that they're now making open source and part of the project. So window farms have been evolving through a rapid versioning process similar to software. And with every open source project, the real benefit is the interplay between the specific concerns of people customizing their systems for their own particular concerns and the universal concerns. So my core team and I are able to concentrate on the improvements that really benefit everyone. And we're able to look out for the needs of newcomers. So for do-it-yourselfers, we provide free, very well-tested instructions so that anyone anywhere around the world can build one of these systems for free. And there's a patent pending on these systems as well that's held by the community. And to fund the project, we partner to create products that we then sell to schools and to individuals who don't have time to build their own systems. Now, within our community, a certain culture has appeared. In our culture, it is better to be a tester who supports someone else's idea than it is to be just the idea guy. What we get out of this project is we get support for our own work, as well as an experience of actually contributing to the environmental movement in a way other than just screwing in new light bulbs. But I think that Eileen expresses best what we really get out of this, which is the actual joy of collaboration. So she expresses here what it's like to see someone halfway across the world having taken your idea, built upon it, and then acknowledging you for contributing. If we really want to see the kind of wide consumer behavior change that we're all talking about as environmentalists and food people, maybe we just need to ditch the term consumer and get behind the people who are doing stuff. Open source projects tend to have a momentum of their own. And what we're seeing is that R&DIY has moved beyond just window farms and LEDs into solar panels and aquaponic systems. And we're building upon innovations of generations who went before us. And we're looking ahead at generations who really need us to retool our lives now. So we ask that you join us in rediscovering the value of Citizens United and to declare that we are all still pioneers.
Now, I like the incredible edible angle, the emphasis on doing it yourself. Not do it yourself in the sense there's only one of you, get a team of people together, but work with them on something that they want to do, not on something they've been forced to do, the way they would be in a hierarchical organization. Now, in case anybody's thinking, well, there's limits to what individuals can achieve when they work together, even if they have coordinating technology such as the internet, they wouldn't be as effective as, say, perhaps the WWF, if they got behind the campaign. We're going to hear an interview with Jonathan Latham about these environmental NGOs and the fact that a lot of them increasingly are doing deals with big business. Did you know, as a matter of history, for example, that a member of the Rockefeller dynasty co-founded the World Wildlife Fund, the Worldwide Fund for Nature as it now is, and another co-founder was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who created the Bilderberg Group. I mean, if you do grow some veggies on your window, at least you know that is definitely a step in the right direction. If you give money to these organizations, even if you're working with organizations in this campaign, if you didn't conceive it, you don't know the people who did, then you can't be 100% sure actually what that's supposed to achieve. Now, I don't think that the hierarchy and the money motivation, which is a sine qua non of all these hierarchical organizations, I don't think that actually helps. I think people opting in on a matter of personal concern, people getting their friends involved, people with whom they already have personal relationships, I think that is a much more resilient, sustainable, decentralized approach. Now let's hear Jonathan Latham. This is from the end of March 2012, and the interview was inspired by an article he wrote for Dollars and Cents entitled Way Beyond Greenwashing: Have Corporations Captured Big Conservation?
Wikipedia defines greenwashing as, quote, a form of spin in which green PR or green marketing is deceptively used to promote the perception that a company's policies or products are environmentally friendly. Bioscientist Jonathan Latham delves deeper into the issue of greenwashing in an article in this month's Dollars and Cents magazine, and he uncovers that some of the biggest conservation nonprofits are shockingly headed by CEOs of major corporations like Coca-Cola and Bank of America. The current leader in the greenwashing industrial commodity agriculture is the Worldwide Fund for Nature, better known as the World Wildlife Fund. Latham found that the World Wildlife Fund's stated role is to, quote, negotiate standards, provide credibility, and lubricate the entry of certified products into international markets. However, as of 2012, major corporations sit on WWF boards. Members of the Roundtable on Responsible Soy include Monsanto, Cargill, Nestle, and BP, companies known to be against environmental regulation and known to be harming the environment through their practices. Identifying the hypocrisy in this scheme, Latham wonders, quote, how many members of the Nature Conservancy will be pleased to find that their organization has been working with Monsanto to promote genetically modified crops as responsible? Jonathan Latham is the executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project based in Ithaca, New York. He now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Jonathan.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, when we think about some of these conservation groups as the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, these are certainly nonprofit organizations that are meant to be promoting the planetary good. But how is it that their boards have come to be occupied by CEOs of major corporations? Did it start out that way?
In some cases, it did. The World Wildlife Fund was founded by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. And so, you know, these organizations have their origins in elite people, if you like, who are friendly with corporations by virtue of what they do and who they are, basically.
And so what exactly are we looking at here in terms of the effects on the planet? Because now more and more people are concerned about climate change, about the environment. It's becoming mainstream. And when we, you know, go to major department stores or retail outlets and we see a stamp on a product that says that it is environmentally friendly, how seriously can we take that?
Well, I think, firstly, it's an extremely important issue. It's hard to overestimate the importance of the sustainability of our food supply. So if you think about the issues that people care about these days, things like coral reefs, things like climate change, things like rainforest, things like habitat protection, all these issues, if you look at them closely enough, you'll see that the food system is the number one problem that these issues face. So the rainforests are being cut down for palm oil plantations, for example. Coral reefs are being threatened by runoff from agricultural fields. So the issue is incredibly important. And the food supply is steadily becoming greenwashed. So you know, if you go to the supermarket, you'll find that there are green labels on all sorts of different things that you can buy. And the food system is basically responding to consumer concerns to develop systems to offer more of those kinds of packaging and greenwashing possibilities.
So what you're saying is that the efforts are being put into labeling products as, say, organic or environmentally sustainable, but not actually practicing them.
Well, in some cases, I mean, I would make a distinction between, you know, there are some things like fair trade and organic that have transparent standards that are upheld by the people who sell the product.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another category of labels where, like the sustainable soybeans and the responsible palm oil that I looked into, where the standards appear to have no reasonable basis at all. You basically are not buying anything when you buy these.
So when they use these terms that don't necessarily have a formal certification attached to them, words like responsible and sustainable. Let's talk about the World Wildlife Fund in particular. What do members of the World Wildlife Fund have to be concerned about with this organization?
Well, I think, you know, there are good things that the World Wildlife Fund does. You know, they do research on habitats, and sometimes they stand up for the right things. But, you know, increasingly they're becoming interested in these sustainability schemes and partnerships with companies. And they are basically the importance of the issues that these sustainability partnerships address way outnumber the importance or outweigh the importance of the research that they do. So, you know, for instance, the World Wildlife Fund could educate its members about the fundamental importance of sustainability in the food supply. But if you read these organizations' magazines, in my opinion, they're full of pap.
So they are working with, and the World Wildlife Fund, whose one of its main goals is to stop deforestation. You say in your article about this in Dollars and Cents magazine that the World Wildlife Fund is essentially giving in to major agricultural industrial companies and giving their maybe what stamp of approval in exchange for some kind of future sustainability goal?
Well, they appear to hope that some rainforests will be saved as a consequence of these schemes. But what the World Wildlife Fund is offering sometimes is positive publicity for these companies, for example, on press releases. And at the moment, companies' products are not being produced with the word WWF on them for the most part. But that is something that may happen in the future. But at the moment, the greenwashing that they're getting from these particular schemes, a lot of it is kind of hidden within the system. You know, as marketing managers and PR people within the system are kind of being worked around to the idea that these soybeans and this palm oil is sustainable, so that when they get to it gets to the marketing stage, then it will feel like a whole scheme is in place, if you like.
And so, what is being sacrificed then? What is the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, these major organizations that you point out in your article, what are the deals that they have come to with some major companies?
Well, the standards, for example, there is sustainable palm oil, there's responsible soybeans, there is one called Bon Sucro, which is a sugar scheme, there is a cotton scheme. But basically, these schemes, what's being sacrificed is, firstly, in countries like the United States, they're undermining genuine standards like organic and fair trade. But in developing countries where the farming is actually being done, where the growing is being done, the mangrove swamps are still being cut down for shrimp farming, and the rainforest is still being cut down for palm oil, for example, and habitats are being destroyed for soybeans. There's no benefit from these schemes.
So what are you saying, that the World Wildlife Fund and Nature Conservancy, et cetera, are agreeing to not activate their members to alert them to some of what these companies are doing, with the promise that these companies will go green in the future?
Well, I don't think there's anything in writing. There's nothing I've seen in writing at which they agree to do this. But obviously, they have, they have partnerships with these companies, and you know, if you look at the structure of these organizations, it's not only that the board members and the CEO are from big companies, but it's also that a lot of the senior management people are from, you know, their last job was at Goldman Sachs, for example. So you know, these people are not lifelong conservationists in many cases. The senior management are people who've been in the corporate sector the whole time, and so they don't have a campaigning mentality. You know, the opportunity for these schemes to come along is basically originates from the fact that there are and have been campaigns against palm oil, for example, to boycott palm oil. that that have been very effective in making the companies concerned that they may lose their markets. And so basically these are the opportunities that are being lost of information and campaigning for the rainforest in countries like the United States.
And so there's also this revolving door between corporations, the corporate executives and the boards of many of these nonprofits. What about soy? Let's talk about soy, because soy is a very important issue and has been brought up certainly in regard to Brazilian rainforests. And soy is used now widely as feed for cattle on an industrial scale. You write about the Roundtable on Responsible Soy in your article in Dollars and Cents magazine. What is this roundtable?
Well, basically, the roundtable was instigated by the WWF, and they wanted to bring together different players from the food supply system. So it has growers in it, so people who actually grow soybeans in Brazil. But then there are also processors, there are packagers, there are supermarkets in the United States and supermarkets in Brazil. So it's the entire food supply that has to be brought on board with a system like this. So they get together and they sort out what they consider to be reasonable standards. But the problem is there's two or three NGOs, and they call it a round table in the sense that everybody has equal input. But unfortunately, there's more than 100 multinational companies on these boards. So, you know, even if the aims of the WWF were straightforward and merely interested in conservation, it would be extremely difficult for them to argue for high standards when you've got 100 other companies arguing against you for basically who wants to do business as usual.
So these companies then in this roundtable on responsible soy will set up certain standards that sound like they might be positive, like, as you quote, pollution is minimized, production waste is managed responsibly, vague terms that are easy to fulfill or may be easy to fulfill or to be, you know, to be used to justify the term responsible as a label for their products?
Yes. I mean, what does a standard mean if something just has to be minimized? You know, does that mean you just have to be as good as everyone else and not be worse? The standards are very, very vague. They also they're going to be difficult to enforce. There are no penalties, for example, for companies that fail to meet those standards. So they have kind of high sounding. You know, if you look at the blurb at the top of these standards, you can make kind of imagine that they're quite good, but the more you look into them, the less likely they are to actually be fulfilled.
So at this point now, Jonathan, what does your article point to in terms of action? Are there other smaller environmental organizations that are noticing this? Because I'm sure in the work of doing environmental conservation, some of the more legitimate organizations that are much more grassroots do come in contact with these bigger organizations, and there must be some knowledge of how these bigger organizations are operating. Is there action on the ground? Are there people that are hoping to expose what the World Wildlife Fund is doing?
There are indeed. What we discovered in our research is that there are a whole series of petitions from a lot of these smaller organizations. So I found more than one petition signed by more than 250 organizations. There's a petition against the soybeans. There's a petition against the palm oil. There's a petition against the shrimp standard that WWF is also involved in. So there are a lot of smaller organizations who are extremely concerned about these developments.
Can you throw out any names for listeners who might be interested in becoming active in the environmental movement but are wary now of the larger groups?
Well, my advice to somebody who wants to do good is if you want to spend money, spending money to absolve your conscience is not, you know, it's not an ideal way to go. But if you want to spend money, then spend it on people that you know, and spend it in your local community, for example, or spend it on local food, for example. If you buy local whole foods, firstly, it won't have that you'll be doing yourself a health benefit, but also you'll be basically avoiding palm oil, soybean oil, etc., all the foods that these companies are relying on. If people stop buying these, you know, Twinkies and junk food type items, then basically the market for these schemes will evaporate.
And do these petitions show, and even the fact that these many of the big agribusiness companies that are trying to, work with the conservation groups to greenwash their products, is that an indication of progress, if you will, that they fear the activism that people are engaged in?
Well, companies, basically what's happening in the food supply is that consumers are becoming more interested in green issues and ethics of, they don't want their foods made by slaves, for example. They're more interested in sustainability. But the direction of the food industry is in many ways the exact opposite. It's becoming more highly concentrated. It's becoming more highly controlled. It's becoming more and more difficult for the big players to deal with small producers. They'd much rather buy their products from all one company. So basically, the entire food system is moving away from sustainability, and yet we have a food movement that is becoming stronger, especially in this country. And so basically the companies fear the food movement, right? And they're on the boards of the non-profits, because they see a way of deflecting the food movement from its goal.
Well, Jonathan Latham, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
I think it's not just the US, I think it's a worldwide movement against food that's come through market mechanisms. The economic theory behind the markets assumes everybody is interested only in themselves and doesn't give a stuff about anyone else. Now, whilst we know that's not true, if people are operating in business mode, if they're willing to say, look, this is what I'm paid to do, my conscience doesn't enter into it, it only takes one self-interested psychopath at the top of the hierarchy to issue some dangerous orders before big problems arise. And now we're going to look, as a case in point, at the utter failure of the US regulatory system to flag up potential dangers of GM foods. Thanks to Sea Change Radio for this, from earlier this year.
It's our children who will be the first generation who will be eating these foods for their entire lives. So this is an experiment on them. That's why this is so troubling to so many people, to so many Americans. We don't know the health risks. We don't know what health problems may come up, in part because there is no labeling.
Have you ever tasted a strawberry whose DNA was altered to include fish genes? Before my interview with today's guest, I would have said that I had not. Now I'd have to say, I really don't know. I know I've never eaten a strawberry whose label indicated that it had been genetically modified. In fact, here in the United States, genetically modified foods are not generally labeled as such. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Charles Margulis, Communications and Food Program Director at the Center for Environmental Health and former lead for Greenpeace's genetic engineering campaign. Margulis believes that American consumers have the right to know when they're eating genetically modified organisms, or as he calls them, unlabeled experimental foods. Listen as we discuss the rise of the GMO, the movement pushing for more regulation of GMOs, and the substantial resistance that proponents of GMO labeling have encountered. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Charles Margulis. He's the communications director for the Center for Environmental Health, which is an organization that works to protect children and families from harmful chemicals and substances in their food, air, and water. Charles, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Your organization has been involved in a GMO labeling campaign. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your efforts.
Sure. This is a nationwide effort with more than 500 organizations working to get the Food and Drug Administration to require labels on genetically engineered food. These are foods that have been hidden in our diets for a little bit over a decade. Unfortunately, most Americans don't even realize that we're eating genetically engineered foods almost every day. That's why we think these foods should be labeled. People have a right to know what's in their food.
And you're not really calling for a ban on GMOs, correct? This is just a transparency issue.
Right. I mean, these are foods that have been altered in ways with a technology that's never before been used in the food supply. So, for example, we have soybeans engineered with petunia genes. Now, that may sound non-problematic on the face of it, but people haven't eaten petunias before. There's no long-term human history of eating petunias. Many of these genetically engineered crops that are used in our diets today have bacterial genes and viral genes and ways of inserting these genes into our foods, that could cause problems. Scientists say could cause problems, health problems, environmental problems, and problems for other farmers. These are all things that consumers want to know about when they go to the store and do their shopping. And unfortunately, we're one of the few countries on the planet that doesn't require labeling of genetically engineered foods.
And the pro-GMO camp has said for many years that GMOs are really nothing new. Genetic modification of our food crops has been done since before the modern era. But these are, as you just mentioned about the petunias, these are a stark departure from traditional methods of animal and plant breeding, right?
Exactly. The industry likes to confuse the notion of breeding crops and animals with genetically engineering them. A scientist I once worked with said, this is like comparing a bicycle to a Formula One race car. Yes, they are both modes of transportation, but that's about where the comparison ends. With traditional breeding, you can't cross unrelated species in ways that don't occur in nature. So, for example, genetic engineers have crossed strawberries with fish genes to create fish berries, strawberries that are engineered to withstand cold temperatures using genes from fish that live in very cold waters.
I think my four-year-old would really like those, actually.
Yeah, so, well, some people love the idea of fish genes in their strawberries, but at the very least, your four-year-old should know that she has that choice to make that dip and not have those engineered strawberries without any labeling. And that's just what we're asking for. We're simply asking for people to label these foods. Obviously, this is completely different than natural breeding. The industry says, well, we've had 10,000 years of safe breeding, and this is just like breeding. Well, you put a fish and a strawberry in a room together, and 10,000 years later, they're not going to breed. That's not going to happen. These unlabeled experimental foods are a widespread experiment on our bodies and our environment. At the very least, we should have labeling so we can know whether or not we want to consent to being part of this experiment.
And some leading technologists like Bill Gates, who's also an important philanthropist, and his organization has done a lot of important work in Africa and other developing areas of the world. He's a noted backer of genetically modified foods, but I couldn't help but think as I read his comments on this. I think he spoke at the World Economic Forum a couple of years ago and was asked about his support for GMOs, and I think he thinks there's great potential for them, but I can't help but think that Bill Gates probably chooses organic foods whenever he does and GMO-free foods because he has that choice.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, the survey after survey shows over more than a decade basically two things about genetically engineered foods. One is that most Americans don't know that we're already eating them. And two, once they realize that we're already eating them, most Americans, 90% or more in most of the surveys, say that they want these foods labeled so they have a choice of whether or not to eat them. And that's consistent over survey after survey over more than a decade.
Whether or not you believe that GMOs are a salvation for feeding our bulging global population, your issue and your organization, you just want transparency and you want people and consumers to know what they're putting into their bodies, which seems like a pretty non-controversial issue. But why do you have to fight for this?
Well, we shouldn't have to fight for that. But unfortunately, the Food and Drug Administration, as far back as the mid-1980s, sided with the biotech industry in what was really a long-term plan to ensure that Americans never find out that this technology is coming into our food supply. So they came up with an idea that they could simply look at a few components of the foods, the protein levels, the fat levels, and not do any really detailed long-term testing, and just look at those levels and say, well, the GMO soybean looks like a natural soybean, it sounds like a natural soybean, I guess it must be the same as a natural soybean. There is no global agreement on this scientific idea that GMOs are no different than natural foods, which is what the FDA will say and what the biotech industry will say. They've said it over and over again for more than a decade. And yet there is no scientific standard to say, yes, these foods are the same. It's simply something they came up, they made up out of whole cloth, basically as a public relations move, not as a scientific move at all. What scientists do say is that this technology is different than breeding. Even the FDA's own scientists, before the first GMO food was approved, said this technology is different than breeding, it has different risks, and it should be regulated differently. There are dozens of papers from FDA's own scientists online that say that, and yet the agency ignored their scientists and sided with the industry.
Charles, when did the FDA first approve a GMO food?
Well, the first genetically engineered food on the market, interestingly, was milk from cows that were injected from a genetically engineered drug called bovine growth hormone. And that was approved in the early 90s, in 92 or 93. There was widespread opposition to allowing BGH milk on the market, especially without labeling. Interestingly, what the FDA did was not only did they not require labels on milk from injected cows, but they also tried to prohibit other dairies and companies from labeling that their foods were not from injected cows. So companies like Ben & Jerry's and Stonyfield Farms and lots of small dairies around the country wanted to put no BGH on their labels, and they were sued by the biotech companies. It was only a settlement that allowed these dairies to put that on their labels, and that settlement is still sometimes contested today, where Monsanto, the world's leading maker of genetically engineered foods, still occasionally goes after dairies and other food companies for no BGH labels.
Now, this would be speculation on your part, but let's go back to the FDA's original thought process that went into trying to quote-unquote veil the American consumer from knowing what's going into their food supply. Do you think it was internally they just thought that this was going to be cost prohibitive and too labor intensive for them to try to track this ever expanding trail of different modified foods or modified ingredients that are going to be going into our food supply? Or do you think there was something a little more devious involved?
Well, we actually don't have to speculate entirely. I mean, the biotech policy was first developed under the Reagan administration, then under the first Bush administration. And when the no labeling policy was released publicly, then Vice President Dan Quayle made the statement on its release, saying this is a welcome regulatory relief for the biotech industry. These were administrations that were hostile to any regulations on any industry, and they saw the biotechnology industry as especially important to the U.S. economy and wanted to have a completely hands-off policy to let the industry basically run amok with our food supply. And unfortunately, that's what's happened.
Do you think that the anti-regulating politicians or the people who espouse a deregulatory environment for pretty much any kind of industry, do you think that the idea of labeling these things to them is a slippery slope?
They will argue that, but what's happened around the world has shown otherwise. So, for example, labeling of GMO foods is required in China, and yet China has a flourishing biotech industry, including making GMO foods. So they're obviously able to both support their scientists in doing this kind of work and allow their consumers to make a free choice. If China can do that, I don't see why we can't do that here.
And getting back to the milk issue, that was a pretty important landmark case, and Monsanto was the, did they develop it, or were they the ones who marketed the bovine growth hormone originally?
Monsanto was one of the developers and original marketers of BGH, along with a couple of other companies.
And how long was BGH in our milk supply without consumers knowing about it?
Unfortunately, BGH is still in the milk supply without consumers knowing it, unless dairy products are labeled no BGH or no RBST, or you may also see no artificial hormones on the labels. Unless you see that, you cannot be sure that the milk from those products did not come from injected cows.
But perhaps these lawsuits with some very well-known brands like Ben & Jerry's not being able to put that something isn't in their products, that could have actually highlighted and educated a populace that didn't know about the possible dangers with BGH before.
That's certainly true. It also unfortunately sets a somewhat risky precedent, putting the onus on producers who are not using a product to label, as opposed to simply requiring labeling when something has changed. I mean, milk was milk for thousands of years. It was completely natural product. Once that milk was changed, it should have been the onus should have been on the people who changed that product to let consumers know. In other words, labeling should have been required on milk that was from cows that were injected with the drug. With GMO crops, the problem gets even trickier because crops pollinate. Genetically engineered corn growing in the Midwest will contaminate natural corn in neighboring farms for thousands of feet, even farther. So a farmer, even an organic farmer, growing natural corn nearby a genetically engineered corn field, can't be sure that that corn, when it's harvested, is going to test clean if somebody does a GMO test on it. And this has happened. Organic farmers have lost sales because companies are doing testing for GMOs and their corn will turn up positive because neighboring pollen drifted over and contaminated their field.
Can you tell us about some of the findings with this first generation of young adults who've grown up with GMOs in our food supply? I'm in my 40s, and as a child, I imagine I didn't have genetically modified foods in my diet. But now that we have a little bit of a history of this, have there been any findings or studies that you could point our listeners to?
Well, that's correct. These foods have been in our diets for just a little over a decade. So it's our children who will be the first generation who will be eating these foods for their entire lives. So this is an experiment on them. That's why this is so troubling to so many people, to so many Americans. We don't know the health risks. We don't know what health problems may come up, in part because there is no labeling. So let's take allergies as an example. If you are having allergic problems and a doctor suspects it's from your diet, what the doctor will do is put you on a restrictive diet. And over a period of days, they'll restrict different foods to see which foods trigger the allergic reaction. Well, if GMO foods aren't labeled, they may never figure out what's triggering that reaction, because one day you may be restricted from tomatoes and be perfectly fine. The next day you're eating tomatoes, you have an allergic reaction. So the doctor says, oh, well, let's see if it's tomatoes. So they'll check it out, and the next day you'll eat a tomato and you'll be perfectly fine. The doctor will say, well, it can't be tomatoes. Well, there's no way to know that, because one of the tomatoes may have been a GMO tomato and one of them wasn't, and it was the GMO tomato that may have caused the allergy. But the doctor will never be able to figure that out because these foods aren't labeled, so we'll never be able to trace the problems back.
Some of these foods that can trigger anaphylactic reactions, like peanuts, we now see labels that say this product was made in a plant that also handled nuts, or it says, you know, may contain traces of peanuts and other nuts. This was not something that just happened because of the self-interest of agribusinesses being sued over people having allergic reactions to their products. It took vigilance and a lot of campaigning by organizations such as your own, I imagine, to make it happen.
That's right. I mean, any parent dealing with allergies knows how serious an issue it is. Even my kids who don't have allergies go to schools where there are kids who have allergies, and the schools have very restrictive policies about bringing in foods with nuts and other materials. This is an especially serious problem with GMOs because it's been proven in numerous experiments that allergies can transfer unexpectedly when you genetically engineer a crop. Now, the FDA and the industry will say, well, if the genes are from a common allergen like a peanut, we would never do that and we would never allow that to go on the market without labeling or testing. And that is true. They do require testing for a few of the most common allergens, about 6 or 7 of the most common allergens. Unfortunately, what that doesn't cover is the thousands and thousands of other genetic types of genetic material that they can be using in our food that's never been in our food before, and that may cause allergies that we'd never know about because they've never been in our diets before. And this also isn't just speculation. This is something that happened in a study a couple of years ago where Australian scientists were trying to develop a new kind of pea so their farmers could have a crop that would resist a certain insect that feeds on the peas there. So they used genes from a bean. Now, beans and peas are relatively closely related, so they expected that this would be no problem. But using genetic engineering, this bean gene inserted into the pea created peas that triggered allergies when they did testing in lab animals. And they had to shut down the project. What's interesting is that those kinds of tests are not required for any GMO crops developed in the U.S. And in the most cases, biotech companies don't do those kinds of tests.
In a best case scenario, Charles, when do you hope to see GMO labels on more products, and what steps need to occur from the FDA standpoint and from the industry standpoint to make it happen?
Well, where we're at right now is Center for Environmental Health and dozens of other organizations have signed on to a petition. This is a legal petition that we sent to the Food and Drug Administration with the lead organizers from the Center for Food Safety about 6 months ago. And that petition lays out the scientific case, the health case, and the public concern about genetically engineered foods, asking the Food and Drug Administration ultimately to require labels on GMO foods. The agency is typically required to respond to that kind of petition within 6 months. The response that was received a couple of weeks ago was, "We're still looking at the petition. We'll get back to you." Unfortunately, that's also very typical. What we hope now is that since more than a million people have signed on to that petition urging the FDA to take that positive action, that that will push the agency to really do something this time. The last time we had this kind of public pressure on the agency in the early 2000s, 2001 and 2002, the agency simply held a series of public hearings around the country. They held three public hearings. I spoke at one of those. It was basically a dog and pony show for the biotech industry to chum up with the FDA and to explain to Americans why we shouldn't worry about these foods and please go away. Well, as you can see, 10 years later, Americans haven't gone away. The a million signatures to the FDA is unprecedented on any kind of issue like this, not just GMOs, but any kind of food labeling issue. And we expect the agency to stand up and pay attention.
Tell us a little bit about some of the boots on the ground with this campaign. It's much bigger than the Center for Environmental Health, obviously. You're a part of this, but who are some of the leaders in this fight, Charles?
Yeah, I mean, the Center for Food Safety is a lead organization. Food and Water Watch has done great work. The Coalition Center is the Just Label It campaign, and folks can go to justlabelit.org and check out all the other campaign partners. Consumers Union, the publisher of Consumer Reports magazine, has been very active on this. And the Organic Consumers Association and hundreds of organic groups across the country. And organic consumers and organic growers are especially concerned because genetic engineering is such a threat to the organic food industry. I mean, we're really at the cusp of where we want to go with our food future right now. And there's two paths, really. The biotech and GMO path means going down the same path that the chemical industry has gone down for the last 100 years. I mean, it's important for people to understand the same companies that produce GMO crops are the companies that produced harmful pesticides for the past 50 years. Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta, DuPont, these are all chemical companies who for 50 years have been saying, without our pesticides, we wouldn't be able to feed the world. Our supermarket shelves would be empty. Our pesticides are the most tested chemicals ever in the history of the planet. Now they're saying the exact same thing about their GMO crops, even though the pesticides have failed to show any of the promises that they claim they would. The GMO crops are not going to measure up to those promises either. We have another choice. The choice is organic and sustainable techniques for farming and food production that don't destroy the planet, that produce food that's healthy, and that produce the kind of food that people want to eat.
And one of the claims by the biotech industry is that this is really a game changer for developing nations and small farmers in countries that didn't traditionally have the wherewithal to compete on a global scale with their crops. What's your perspective on that, Charles?
Well, anytime they're threatened, the pesticide industry says the same thing. When Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, that exposed the hazards of pesticides, they put out a book to counter her called The Desolate Years, which said without pesticides, people in Africa and people in Asia would starve. It's the same old line they trot out every time they're threatened. and it has no backing at all. In fact, GMO crops are made for farmers in the U.S., for first world farmers, so that they can continue to use pesticides. So, for example, the most widely grown GMO crop on the planet is Monsanto's Roundup Ready soybeans. These are soybeans that are engineered to be sprayed with high doses of Monsanto's farm chemical called Roundup. Roundup is an herbicide that basically kills any plant that grows, except it doesn't kill Roundup Ready crops because they're genetically engineered to withstand spraying of this chemical. Now, Monsanto had a patent on Roundup that expired around the year 2000. They started developing their Roundup Ready crops in the early 1990s because they could patent those and sell them along with Roundup to farmers so that they would win two ways. They'd have higher price for their Roundup Ready seed, and they'd continue to be able to sell their Roundup even though they lost the patent on it, and generic versions of it are on sale for cheaper. This is a great strategy for continuing to sell nasty chemicals to spray on risky experimental foods, but it's not going to feed the world.
Charles, what are some of the ways that our listeners could become involved in some of the work that the Center for Environmental Health is engaged in?
Well, in addition to our food work, Center for Environmental Health works on safer electronics. We work on chemical policy reform, and we do product testing. So we were one of the lead groups on testing toys and other children's products for lead that led to the first ever federal law that bans lead in all of children's products. And folks can come to our website, which is ceh.org, or also look in our blog, which is generationgreen.org. And there are lots of ways to get involved.
Now, not wanting to end on a negative note, I thought we'd return to the topic of growing local food. It's not something that's just done in Europe. It does happen in the US. And this is from a program called Living on Earth from March 2012 about the recent announcement of a Seattle food forest. Fruit trees are about the highest in terms of energy output per energy input. Over the lifetime of the tree, you just need patience to wait for the tree to start bearing, and then you're getting a lot of fruit with minimal energy input. The best time to plant a fruit tree is 10 years ago, and the second best time is now.
Well, about 200 years ago, John Chapman made a name for himself by walking the Ohio River Valley, preaching the gospel, and planting orchards along the way. In doing so, Johnny Appleseed passed along food for thought and created forests that frontier folk could feast on. And today, city dwellers in Seattle are likewise spreading the word and preparing to plant seeds and seedlings to create an urban food forest. In the Beacon Hill neighborhood overlooking the Seattle skyline, Jenny Pell is helping residents of the community convert a 7-acre plot of city grass into a forest Johnny Appleseed would eat up. And if things work out, so will a lot of locals. Jenny Pell is a permaculturalist specializing in creating sustainable community landscapes and designer of the Beacon Hill Food Forest. Welcome to Living on Earth.
It's great to be here.
So what's a food forest?
Well, a food forest is a system that we designed to mimic a natural forest ecosystem. So we're trying to fill in those same elements of a natural forest with things that are edible, useful. We're looking at big overstory canopy trees, smaller trees that fit into that, going down to a shrub layer, down to sort of an herbaceous layer and ground cover, and all the way down into the rhizosphere, into the root zone.
So things like mushrooms, vines, herbs, berries, nuts, that kind of thing?
Absolutely, yeah. In this project, this food forest, when we met with all the different people from the community, what they wanted absolutely was fruits and berries and big nut trees. That was their biggest request. So we're looking at paths with berry bushes on both sides, and we're going to have mixed fruit orchards and big nut orchards. And one of the nut orchards I'm designing has a very specific Asian tilt to it, so it's going to have big overstory sweet chestnuts, and the understory will have persimmons and mulberries and Chinese haws, and then going down into the lower zone will be really familiar herb and lower plants from the Asian palette.
How do you mimic a forest without turning it into something, you know, that Disney would like?
Well, I don't know that it would be bad if Disney liked it.
Can you design something that's natural?
You can. But we're really good at picking things that are going to play well together. So we're going to see like the overstory canopy tree is going to let in a little bit of shade, which is going to allow this next thing to grow. And then on the edge, we're going to have a whole lot of sun, but the larger trees behind it are going to shelter it from aggressive winds and things like that. And then when we step back, those plants are going to grow in their own relationships. Nature kind of takes over at that point.
This seems as much philosophy as farming.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Permaculture is an ethical framework with a lot of principles that give us a design methodology, really trying to get to sustainable, resilient human communities, and also embed the skills in the community, invite people back into that process, get people excited about learning skills.
In terms of the one in Seattle, what kind of skills will these people need, and who are they that are going to build this?
This neighborhood is a really fascinating neighborhood. It's one of the most ethnically diverse zip codes in the United States. And so we have folks who are Latino, we have folks from many different Asian countries, we have African Americans, we have recent African immigrants, really, really different folks living there.
Can anybody kind of walk in and feast on your forest?
For the private garden plots, those are really people's individual vegetable gardens. And no, we don't want anybody helping themselves to those. But for the rest of the garden, the invitation, again, is going to be this garden takes work, and you certainly are welcome to help yourself to some. And if you want to get involved in bigger harvests, come on harvest day and help out. That'll be pruning the trees, mulching the trees. That'll be propagating from some of the plants. So we're hoping that people will come in and, for example, help cut the raspberries back and then take home 5 or 10 raspberry plants to put in their own backyard. People have been signing up by the score with the comments like, put me to work. I can't wait to get my hands dirty. Let me know when I can show up with my wheelbarrow.
Now, as I understand it, this is going to be the largest food forest of its kind.
That's not entirely true. It'll be the largest food forest on public lands in the United States. So food forests are not new. There are really large food forests in other parts of the world. That is one I've seen a video on that's in the Middle East. That's a 2,000-year-old food forest with overstory date palms and bananas and persimmons and citrus, and it's pretty amazing. But it's been continually managed over time for 2,000 years. So I think what's captured people's imagination so much about this project worldwide is that it's so solutions-oriented and it's so accessible.
So Jenny Pell, fast forward 2,000 years, you come back to the Beacon Food Forest. Is it still going to be there?
Let's jump forward 2,000 years. Let's jump forward 20 years first. What I would like to see there is that this food forest, I'm going to call it one of the living genetic banks of really valuable material in the Pacific Northwest. And what I'd like to see that is kind of a seed nursery or a plant nursery that's going to propagate and spread well beyond the borders of that food forest. That I can imagine just sort of blossoming all across the Seattle landscape. Also, in a lot of ways, this park is intended to serve the local neighborhood. We already recognize that it's going to become a destination for people. Other people are going to come and want to look at it and maybe replicate it. So what pieces of this are going to inspire people to take it and make it their own?
Jenny, you got a forest in your backyard?
I'm renting a house right now, but what I do have is a young food, a mixed annuals and perennials garden in the parking strip. Seattle, a couple years ago, had the Year of Urban Agriculture, and they gave up all the parking strips. If you want to grow food in them, you can grow anything you want. So I put in berries and fruit trees, and you name it, I got it growing.
I'm coming to your house. That's great.
Yeah, we grow a lot of food. I mean, we grow food year-round in my garden here in Seattle.
I've planted thousands of fruit trees this year. Been growing mostly on my veranda and on a piece of disused land I found. I hope this show's encouraged you to get some planting done, or if you're growing, to grow some more. Maybe get some neighbors involved.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.